Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. I want to focus this week on the conflict in Ukraine, and as with previous weeks, I want to offer a critical view of the politics surrounding the Russian assault. I'll take an obligatory moment here to, once again, make clear that I see no justification for the invasion and certainly no excuse for targeting civilians or critical civilian infrastructure. The invasion is wrong. Putin is a war criminal, as are, by the way, George Bush, Dick Cheney, the late Madeleine Albright, and Colin Powell, all of whom actively prosecuted unjust wars that claimed hundreds of thousands of lives. As with the U.S. war in Iraq, our regime change actions in Libya or Haiti or Panama, it is foolishly dangerous to focus on the macro details without analyzing the underlying history and motivations. I have, from the start, insisted that the war in Ukraine is a proxy war between the superpowers and has more to do with the U.S. goal of economic and political domination in Europe than with Putin's expansionist aspirations. The United States has foregone or ignored every opportunity for a diplomatic resolution, even dismissing treaties offered by Russia that would, if agreed to, have denied Putin any pretense for attacking Ukraine in the first place. We can quite reasonably question whether Putin could be trusted, but we really ought to be asking whether our government can be trusted either. And for every blatant hypocrisy of Putin's, such as his claim to be protecting Russian-speaking Ukrainians in the Donbass region, the United States is guilty of another. And while Putin has made no public overtures about attacking or annexing countries beyond Ukraine, the United States' rhetoric about strengthening NATO and perhaps even exceeding NATO's charter by means of some unified military response involving NATO nations without there being an attack on any of them that would invoke the Article 5 mutual defense obligation. Nothing the United States has done in Ukraine thus far has diminished or prevented any bloodshed. Indeed, it seems that in many ways the West's actions could only hope to prolong the conflict in search of a military rather than a political solution. Since initially speaking out on their perspective, others have come forward in concurrence, including Professor John Mearsheimer, Russian journalist Vladimir Posner, Code Pink's Medea Benjamin, Roots Action's Jeff Cohen, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, actor and blogger Russell Brand, and Professor Noam Chomsky, to name a few. Yet it seems that, as with the start of the U.S. war in Iraq, anyone who deviates even just a little from the carefully crafted State Department narrative gets labeled a puppet for Putin, or a Russian propagandist. Well, despite those slings and arrows, in today's show, we'll hear a recent production of Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy, hosted by Anne Garrels, in which are featured, in classic Pacifica tradition, a range of viewpoints not commonly found in the mainstream broadcasts.
We have created a situation for Russia where they have had no choice but to build a doomsday machine. And let's hope they never have to use it.
MIT professor Theodore Postol on the escalating danger of an accidental nuclear war.
If any person on this earth, not just the labor, but any, especially working class people, need to recognize the danger that we're in and that the people who are the oligarchs, the elite, they will stop at nothing to keep the riches and dominate the planet. And if we don't stop this, it's going to be the death of us all.
As calls for a no-fly zone over Ukraine mount on mainstream media, working people stand against more war.
My God, all wars are evil and all victims deserve support. And until we get on that page, we have no credibility whatsoever.
And the air power summary data reveal that the United States has dropped 3,246 bombs and missiles on Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, 2,068 under Donald Trump, and 1,178 under Joe Biden, just since the end of February 2020. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and radio affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. In this hour, we'll examine the Russia-Ukraine conflict from different perspectives in the spirit of Pacifica Radio's mission, which is to contribute to an understanding of conflicts and to promote peace. First, we'll hear Theodor Posol, Professor Emeritus of Science, Technology, and International Security at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Prior to his work at MIT, he worked at Argonne National Laboratory, the Pentagon, and Stanford University. On March 11, he spoke to Veterans for Peace about the escalating danger of nuclear war.
What I'm going to try to talk about today is what I consider to be the grave danger of accidental nuclear war that we're now facing. The important point to keep in mind is that there are an uncountable and infinite number of possibilities that could lead to an action and reaction cycle that could lead to escalation and a nuclear exchange that would destroy civilization as we know it. What I want to do is to give you some sense of how serious the consequences of a rapid escalation could be. What I'm showing you here is an image of the Pentagon. Probably everyone here knows it. The inner circle here shows the accuracy of a Trident II nuclear ballistic missile. The Trident II is the most accurate nuclear weapon in the American arsenal that's delivered by ballistic missile. Trident operates at sea, the large ocean areas where it hides, and it has this killing power that is far greater than the killing power of any of our or Russia's ICBMs. Now, the fact that this missile is so potentially dangerous from the Russian point of view is that it has the combination of accuracy and yield to use only a small number of Trident warheads to essentially destroy the entire land-based retaliatory forces of Russia, ICBM forces. So this poses a major, major threat from the point of view of, shall we call it, nuclear warfighting. Now, nuclear warfighting is an oxymoron. Anyone who gets into a nuclear war is going to be dead, along with anyone else they fight. But the fact of the matter is that the United States could never have developed a system with this kind of accuracy if we weren't at some level thinking about maybe fighting a nuclear war. The Russians have not missed this. This is a big item on the screen of a military planners in Russia, and they are very concerned about the potential for a Trident II attack against Russian strategic nuclear forces. The most dangerous part of a nuclear weapon is the extraordinary temperature of the fireball, not the blast. Most people think, oh, the blast wave is terrible. It is. It's very destructive. But the real destructive feature of a nuclear weapon is, you should think of it as like a little piece of the sun that has been brought down to the earth and allowed to radiate its energy for a few seconds or fractions of seconds of time. Since it's so hot and so much light and heat is radiating from it, it sets things on fire at great distances. This is one of the real destructive concerns from a nuclear weapon. Just to give you a feel for the scale of consequence for a single Russian nuclear warhead, one of maybe 1,000 of land-based ICBMs that we would be trying to destroy if we attacked it first. When the weapon is detonated, it creates a fireball. What happens is the nuclear weapon generates an enormous amount of energy in a very short period of time and in a very small volume of space, that the internal energy inside the nuclear weapon reaches 100 million degrees Kelvin. That's about 5 times hotter than the center of the sun. Now, what happens in about 1 second after the initial detonation, X-rays from the super hot weapon immediately pour out into the surrounding air, and they heat the surrounding air to fantastic temperatures, maybe a few million degrees. And this very superheated air starts expanding out like a fast-moving piston, and it moves out against the surrounding air causing the surrounding air to pile up into a shockwave of enormous extent. Below this fireball, the ground would be exploding. I mean, literally exploding from the light and heat from the fireball, which is so immense that concrete would literally explode into dust. Nobody, of course, in this area would be aware of what's going on because everyone would be dead because the superheated light from the fireball has already destroyed everything that matters on the ground, that's reachable on the ground. But this is one nuclear weapon out of thousands. I'm not trying to say this is what would happen. I'm just trying to show you the potential consequences on a very small scale relative to the kinds of things that could be much larger. And if we talk about an uncontrolled escalation, would in fact be almost certainly much larger, involving hundreds. And I think my own view, guess, it's a guess, is thousands of nuclear weapons, essentially destroying civilization as we know it. So that's what's at stake. And this is all due to people making decisions that start an action reaction cycle that nobody knows how to control because nobody has the information and understanding of the situation and the communications capability to stop what's going on. I can't say what it would be. Hopefully we'll never see it. If we ever see it, none of us are going to be around to study it, you know, because we won't know what happened. No one will know what happened because everything will have been destroyed. Russia and the United States have both built warning systems against long-range nuclear missile attack. And the United States has done the best that can be done. It's not adequate. I'm not suggesting it's adequate, but it's the best that can be done. And the United States can see the launch of Russian ballistic missiles in Russia with satellites we have deep in space. The rockets typically take 3 to 5 minutes of powered flight, and we would know almost at launch that these rockets were in flight because our systems are that good. And we would be sending out information to our military leadership that an attack is underway. Now, the president wouldn't necessarily know because the military leadership would have to look at the data and decide whether or not the data is real, you know, because false alarms do occur. And who knows how long they would take. Typically, people think 5 or 6 minutes or whatever. Who knows? Then we would have about 20 minutes. We could not see the warheads when they're drifting through space. We only see the rockets when their rocket motors are burning. 25 minutes after launch, they would start breaking the radar screen of our early warning radars. Once those warheads are observed by the radar, it takes a few minutes to get enough tracking information to have an estimate of where they're going to actually land. And the estimates are very rough. But they tell us if hundreds are coming toward the middle of the United States, to the coasts, everywhere, you know. So that we will have that information 9 to 15 minutes before their impact. And then they would impact. And most people who worry about nuclear war fighting assume that a very large number of these warheads would be aimed at the Minuteman ballistic missiles in the Midwest of the United States. The objective would be to try to destroy these missiles while they're still in their launch silos. Now, of course, that's a big gamble because we would see them coming for 30 minutes and we can launch these rockets within minutes. We need a presidential decision. If I were advising a president during one of these horrifying scenarios, and believe me, I wouldn't be, it'd be some political person who's worried more about what the Republicans are going to say than what's actually happening. And I can back that up with data. If you have a really knowledgeable person there, what they would tell the president is, who cares about the ICBMs? If we need to retaliate, we have submarines that will destroy the Soviet Union or Russia, in this case, many times over. We don't know this attack is real. There are all kinds of complicated communication systems involved. My advice to you, Mr. President or Ms. President, don't do anything. Because there will be no ambiguity if this is a real attack, and there will be no problem retaliating. That would be my advice. But I doubt a president would get that advice. Certainly when I was in the Pentagon, that was not the advice that was given the president. The president was told in briefings, I saw some of those briefings, how much time they had to launch the ICBMs. Even though we had bombers and submarines that could end Russia, the Soviet Union at that time, and there was no need to launch on such a short timeline. But in any case, well, if you think this timeline is short, you want to see what the Russians are facing. They don't know the missile is launched until it breaks their radar horizon, because their satellite systems cannot see the ocean areas from which Trident operates. You need a military conference to determine what's happening, what kind of response you're going to have. So you see, I've already used up four or five minutes, and that's a very generous number, because then you're going to decide how to respond. So you're talking 6 or 8 minutes just to decide, know you're under attack, and decide how to respond. If you have eight or 10 minutes warning time, you don't have the time to make any kind of decision. So the only thing you can do if you're Russia is to have a system of pre-delegation of launch authority. You tell people in the field, if you lose communication with me, if you detect a nuclear detonation on Moscow or near Moscow, you are now free to launch your forces under your own control. You don't need leadership to say go ahead or not. This is, in effect, a doomsday machine. We have created a situation with Russia. And I'm saying we, because we could have corrected this. I've been working on this for 20 years and being laughed at for 20 years. We could have corrected this. We have created a situation for Russia where they have had no choice but to build a doomsday machine. And let's hope they never have to use it.
That was Theodore Postol, MIT Professor Emeritus of Science, Technology, and International Security.
I've been waiting for something to happen, for a week or a month or a year, with the blood and the ink of the headline and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you think that you've heard it before, how governments lie to their people and how nations are driven to war. There are shadows on the faces of the men who fanned the flame. To those wars that are fought in places we can't even remember their name. On the radio, talk shows, and TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom and how we come to the aid of a friend. Well, who are these ones we call our friends? These governments killing their own? Or is it the ones who can't take anymore, so they pick up a brick or a gun or a stone? There are lives in the balance. There are people under fire. There are children at the cannons. And there is blood on the wire. There is blood on the wire. There is blood on the wire. There is.
That was Lives in the Balance, sung by Richie Havens. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Next, we'll hear from Dan Dyson, president of the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America, Illinois Division, in conversation with Nick Espinoza of Pacifica affiliate station WHRU in Chicago.
Have you been in touch with your relatives in Ukraine? Are they okay? Do you know what's going on?
I have. My relatives live in Western Ukraine, where fighting hasn't broken out at this point, not yet. My family right now is good. I do have a cousin who lives in Donbass, who moved there as a young lady. She was married there, and her husband is from that region. Unfortunately, we have lost touch with her since 2014, when so-called separatists who were, again, you know, Russian mercenaries, Russian proxies, basically tried to do a breakaway republic. We have lost touch with her since then. But my other family is right now fine. They're watching, unfortunately, this human tragedy unfold. They are on the path where, you know, right now, 500,000 refugees are fleeing and moving, you know, trying to get to countries like Poland, you know, Poland, Romania, right. Hungary, Czech Republic, that are thankfully allowing them safe passage and refuge in those countries.
I wanted to actually talk to you basically to get the Ukrainian American perspective on the situation. Sure. You're from Chicago, obviously. So we have a large Ukrainian population here in Chicago. Yes. And by virtue of that, I'd like to know what Ukrainian Americans are doing to try and help those and their family in Ukraine. Is there an apparatus set up for them to, in some way, shape, or form, send money or help in any way?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The National Bank of Ukraine had actually set up an account where people can send money directly for, of course, buying military supplies, humanitarian aid. Unfortunately, some of the websites or some of the transfers have been hacked by Russian hackers, and the money is not getting there. In Chicago, we've set up an account at the Self-Reliance Credit Union, where we have an account set up for relief of Ukraine. People can send their donations there. Mm-hmm. We have agencies that we are working with that are thought of very highly in Ukraine. Our national board is tied in with a French, it's basically Doctors Without Borders. They're based in Ukraine. They've got warehouses through Ukraine. They do supplies for, of course, humanitarian causes. They supply medical kits to the army. They've been operating in Ukraine for many, many years. We trust them. Yesterday at our rally, Congressman Quigley had said that he was going back to D.C., and they're going to be introducing a TPS request, temporary protective status request for Ukrainians to come into the country. Unfortunately, a lot of times those people get taken advantage of. So we are going to look to see what happens with that. We have a relief committee that we have at our headquarters in New York. That relief committee has been operational since the 40s, actually. We're going to be coordinating with them when refugees will be coming in, where they will be. We have a tremendous amount of people that are opening up their hearts and are willing to open up their homes to refugees if they can make it over here. We are grateful to the nations of Poland, Hungary, Romania. Romania, we saw pictures on CNN where people were lined up at the border crossing, taking complete strangers because they knew the scope of the human tragedy. So, you know, it's a full front, let's call it a full frontal support for refugees. We are collecting funds. Funds will be appropriated to the appropriate organizations that help support. The unfortunate thing is, in times like this, there's always what I term the charlatans, carpetbaggers, thieves that set up these fake websites, donate to this cause, we're helping, and it basically the money goes sideways. We saw this in 2004. We saw this more prevalently in 2014, where there was, you know, people absolutely, you know, they donated 0.5% of what they collected, and the rest was basically misappropriated. So we are cautioning our supporters, Ukrainian Americans, everybody who wants to donate to the cause, because we have tremendous support within the Polish community, all the Baltic community, the Azerbaijani community, not to fall into the trap of donating to someone out of the blue who's claiming that they are helping the country. Go use the legitimate sources.
Right.
The Ukrainian Congress Committee of America has been around since 1949. We are trusted. We are recognized. Please send your donations, you know, through the sources that are respectable and are known.
That was Dan Dyson, president of the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America, Illinois Division. The Deep Dive Security Show with Nick Espinoza focuses on all things cybersecurity, cyber warfare, cyber terrorism, and technology related. broadcasting out of Chicago via WHRU for Pacifica. Aaron Wright is an ILWU Local 10 business agent. He spoke with Pacifica's Steve Seltzer about the U.S. military drive against Russia and the growing calls for war by both Democrats and Republicans.
Every scholar on Russian history, you can go back 25 years, every scholar on Russian history said, if you push NATO to the west of the Russian borders, you're going to have problems with Russia. The United States funded an overthrow of the Ukrainian government in 2014 under Obama, Biden. They gave billions of dollars in aid and weapons to the new Ukrainian government, which has shut down TV stations and jailed their opposition parties, which doesn't reek of democracy to me. Also, a large percentage of their armed forces are Nazis. They have the Azov Battalion. They wear swastikas. We basically are arming and training Nazis in Eastern Europe. And you can do a quick thought exercise. If China and Russia overthrew Mexico's government, funded them with billions of dollars of weapons, and there were shells falling and killing Americans, I don't think it would take last 2 minutes before we went in. So this is predicted. It's insanity. It's done to protect the petrodollar status. It's done to protect U.S. hegemon over the world. They're willing to flip over the whole chessboard in order to stay in power and win the game, which is playing with all of our lives. And whether or not there's a nuclear war, which, you know, anyone could go on YouTube and type in Plan A, and you will see there will be no surviving that. This cutting off of Russia and grain, one-third of the supply of grain for the world, is huge. It will cause starvation. It's going to cause mass shortages of food around the world. It's going to hit us. There'll be spiking prices, food shortages. We already have a problem with poverty in this country. Inflation last year was 15%. Doesn't look like it's going to slow down. And that's, you know, you're losing almost half of your purchasing power in 2 years from inflation alone. We are in trouble. We are in real trouble.
And the AFL-CIO, most of the unions in this country have supported military spending, $840 billion a year. They take $75 million a year from the National Endowment for Democracy. It's a government-funded nonprofit for intervention, like in Ukraine. The AFL-CIO was involved in supporting union people in Ukraine who wanted privatization of the wealth of Ukraine. What role should the labor movement here be playing in relationship to Ukraine and with workers in other countries as far as real solidarity?
I think that any person on this earth, not just the labor, but any, especially working class people, working people, need to recognize the danger that we're in and that the people who are the oligarchs, the elite, they will stop at nothing to keep the riches and dominate the planet. And if we don't stop this, it's going to be the death of us all. It could very well be. Supporting an almost $1 trillion arms industry, that's our number one export. You know, we're dealing in death and destruction all over the planet. You know, everyone wants to yell at Russia, you know, the jingoism of going to war and resisting Russia and support Ukraine, when we've done the same thing in Syria. Same thing in Libya. We did the same thing in Iraq. We just spent 20 years doing it in Afghanistan, bombing the crap out of people. We ran out of bombs at one point under Obama. We ran out of bombs, bombing people. It's just suicidal mania to try to keep this system going the way it is, and it's pure hypocrisy to be yelling, we support Ukraine and arm Ukraine against Russia when we've done the same thing Russia's doing to Ukraine right now for decades.
And we're speaking with Aaron Wright, and the expenditure of war. You're talking about this effect of cutting off the grain, the oil, of massive inflation, starvation. It seems like we're going into a real worldwide confrontation with working people, really, because working people are the ones that pay for these wars.
Yeah, the effect, you know, I mean, the billionaires have their bunkers, you know. They have their stock portfolios. They have their, you know, they have their yachts. They have their, you know, they fly around in their jets telling us all we need to consume less and watch our CO2 footprint while they're flying around, you know, polluting. The 1% of the population that they are pollutes hundreds of times more than the normal people. I mean, these people are a parasite on us, and they're going to bring about our destruction, and it's time to stop listening to them. It's time to stop doing their bidding. It's time to work for a common good and towards some kind of system that takes care of the people and the planet.
Well, it's interesting that they're talking about seizing the yachts of the oligarchs in Russia. What about the oligarchs here, Bezos and Elon Musk and these oligarchs? I guess they're the good oligarchs.
I like to point out, I think it was Politico that did an article recently. They got a leaked batch of documents going back a good 15, 20 years. And if you name the billionaire, any billionaire you could name off the tip of your tongue, none of them pay taxes. None of them. And these documents showed that. Bezos even got tax credits. And it's just, I pay, as a California citizen, 30% federal, 10% state, and 10% sales tax. That's half of my income goes to taxes, which goes to these wars that are destroying this planet, destroying people. I mean, why are we paying for our own homicide? Why are we paying for our own destruction? You know, maybe that's the answer. We need to all stop paying these taxes.
The issue of politics of it, because the Democrats and Republicans are united, it seems, on this war in Ukraine, on mobilizing, sending more arms and jets to surround Russia. You have in Oakland, the Democrats are united to support a billionaire and even give him hundreds of millions, $800 million in tax dollars. It seems like there's a political vacuum and that working people don't have their own representative, their own party to defend their interests. In both cases, on an international level and here, right here in the Bay Area?
Not at all. We definitely need a political party that represents people. And we need a media that represents the truth. You know, one of the things that's creating this problem is that censorship and media concentration have basically put information out of reach of the general populace. You know, the people don't really know what's going on. They're not being told the full truth. And it's very dangerous when you start censoring. And the censorship and the deplatforming of any voices that are outside of the mainstream media. And then also criminalization of dissent. You know, they're talking, Homeland Security is talking about if you spread misinformation now, that it's an act of terrorism. You know, these are trends that lead to dictatorial, authoritarian, totalitarian systems that will do nothing but oppress us. And we need to recognize that and support our rights, our freedoms, and there's free speech. Because without that, you know, habeas corpus, we're done.
And we're speaking with Aaron Wright, a business agent, ILW Local 10, and it could end up that if you're opposed to the war with Russia, you're a terrorist.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you oppose, you know, if you criticize any of the COVID policies, you know, the last couple of years, they really want to paint everyone with some kind of label, like they're calling people who dissent right-wingers or Nazis or KKK, when we are actually in Ukraine funding Nazis, flag-waving, swastika-bearing Nazis. Not only that, those funds are training Nazis from all over the world. They're going to Ukraine and being trained by Nazis. So the hypocrisy, again, is just stark. It's day and night. It's insanity.
That was Aaron Wright of ILWU Local 10, interviewed by Pacifica's Steve Seltzer regarding the war in Ukraine, labor, and growing domestic censorship and repression of dissenting voices.
At the end of World War III, amid the lightning and thunder, those left alive, as long as they live, will wonder. Was there something that could have been done before nuclear winter blocked out the sun, after the earth that we once knew was blown asunder? At the end of World War III, any pundits who may still be found will have heated debates about how the end came round. Was it the Black Sea blockade, when the rush for the end times was made, or the breaking of promises promised when the wall came down? At the end of World War III, as people look for clean water to drink, as they're dreaming of the days when they had a kitchen sink, wishing they could try again to talk to belligerent men back when we were only hanging on the brink.
That was At the End of World War III by David Rovics. The independent news outlet The Gray Zone published an article on March 4 titled, quote, "How Ukraine's Jewish President Zelensky Made Peace with Neo-Nazi Paramilitaries on Front Lines of War with Russia," unquote. Author, journalist, and founder of The Gray Zone, Max Blumenthal, discussed this piece with Scott Horton of Anti-War Radio on KPFK, Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles. Here's part of their conversation.
We've been watching this since 2014. I personally have been against the war in Ukraine since 2014, and I've been writing about this issue of open neo-Nazi influence over the Ukrainian military, society, and government, often against the wishes of many Ukrainians, since 2014. And I've come under heavy attack for it. I remember the first time I wrote about this in Alternet, a New York Times editorial appeared calling me one of Putin's puppets, simply for mentioning that this neo-Nazi battalion known as the Azov Battalion had been incorporated into the Ukrainian National Guard.
Yeah, well, I know for a fact that that's true, that you've been writing about this since then. I know for a fact that you've been writing about this since before the coup in February 2014, because you and I were retweeting each other the night that they sacked the government buildings on the 22nd of February. And you said, hey, look, they're putting up Confederate flags and Nazi Iron Crosses and swastikas in the city council building, I think it was. Right there in downtown Kiev that night. And you already knew what was going on there at that time, as I remember, as we already did. This had been going on for months, that protest in the Maidan out there, being led by these incredibly, you know, and apparently, take one look at them, these extremely dangerous skinhead Nazis, Right Sector, Svoboda, and then, you know, I guess later we learned the names of all the rest, C-14 and Azov and all the rest of these. But that was all apparent in the streets, and I can vouch for you. I know that you wrote about it then because I read you.
Yeah, C-14, which is the youth wing of the Svoboda Party, which was rallying on the Maidan with John McCain and Senator Chris Murphy from Connecticut, the Democrat, as now Deputy Secretary of State Victoria Nuland was handing out cookies. Their youth wing sacked Kiev City Hall, as you said, adorned it with Nazi symbols, literal Third Reich flags. And then when the Berkut, the national police, the riot police, came in and stormed City Hall to remove them, they took shelter, guess where? In the Canadian embassy, with the full support of the Canadian embassy. Mm-hmm. This is a neo-Nazi group, C-14, that is named after the famous 14 words of the neo-Nazi organizer in the U.S., David Lane, about securing the future of the white race for our white children. The Canadian embassy that gave them shelter. This is the same Canadian government that branded its own citizens Nazis for protesting mandates. I think like one Confederate flag was seen there. But this has been happening in the open. 4 years after this incident, the C-14 neo-Nazi militia was hired essentially by the Kiev City Council under the new pro-US Maidan regime to carry out pogroms against families of Roma people who were sleeping under bridges and in and around a train station in Kiev. They carried out this pogrom on camera, pepper spraying and brutalizing with clubs, completely defenseless Roma people in official partnership with the Kiev City Council. And this is documented in my piece with Alex Rubenstein. We've documented it in the past. Sergei Bondar, one of the leaders of that pogrom, went on just weeks later to speak at the America House in Kiev, which is a meeting center maintained by an NGO funded by the U.S. government. It was connected to the U.S. embassy. And at the time, the U.S. was openly training and arming the Azov Battalion, which is an openly neo-Nazi paramilitary incorporated into the Ukrainian National Guard, whose founder, Andrei Beletsky, has said in writing in 2010 that his mission is to destroy the Semitic Untermensch. Those were the exact words he used. This is a group that is photographed with U.S. military trainers with Nazi wolf's angle symbols on their arms, with uniformed military commanders on their own website. I mean, none of this is hidden. They appear in the field with U.S. Light anti-tank weapons. This has been going on for years, and Congress has even openly debated this issue. It was also in 2018 that the office of Representative John Conyers, late Democrat from Michigan, attempted to put a provision in the NDAA to prevent the funding or arming of the Azov Battalion by the Pentagon. But as we can see right now, they're in the field again with U.S. weapons.
We're talking with Max Blumenthal from the Gray Zone Project about this controversial piece, how Ukraine's Jewish president, Zelensky, made peace with neo-Nazi paramilitary. So we're going to get to the Zelensky angle here in a second. And I know this is stupid. I'll beg your forbearance. But we are in a time of some pale, farcical imitation of the Red Scare here. And you brought this up before. It's worth addressing. If the right wing of the Ukrainian nationalists fighting against the Russians in Ukraine right now are a bunch of Hitler-loving Nazis, as you describe them, does that make the Russians a bunch of heroes, Max?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not here to endorse anything Russia's doing. It's simply about providing context, because Russia doesn't care what we say in the U.S. Russia doesn't care what the anti-war movement says. The American government does care what we think, and that's why it's waging this massive propaganda campaign to paper over what the U.S. government has been supporting and how the U.S. government, through NATO and through the Pentagon, has incited this conflict and brought 1,000 or so U.S. military trainers to Russia's doorstep to work hand in glove with the Ukrainian military and literal neo-Nazi paramilitaries. The conflict has been raging since 2014, and we need to understand what it's about. There are two breakaway republics in the Donbass region, Lugansk and Donetsk, that are majority Russian-speaking, that did not want to be part of this new pro-NATO Kiev regime that wanted to remove Russian as an official language, that attacked the Russian Orthodox Church, which was their faith community, and which had massacred large numbers of Russian speakers, including in a pogrom or just a slaughter in Odessa in 2014, when a group of ethnic Russians started an Occupy-style protest in front of the National Trade Union in Odessa, and they were set upon by fascist thugs weaponized by the Ukrainian intelligence service, the SBU, driven into the trade union, which was then set on fire. And as they jumped out of windows, they either died or were beaten with clubs on camera by these thugs. Incidents like that flowed freely into the fighting in the East, where a lot of these ultra-nationalist militants and thugs turned into paramilitary units. And then people in the Donbass on the pro-Russian side organized their own militias. And that fighting has been going on since 2014, leaving 13, 14,000 dead. According to the UN, most of the dead are on the pro-Russian side. And that's really the backdrop for this war. So we have to understand, we're getting the narrative of the Ukrainian side anytime you turn on cable news. If you want to get an Uber, then it asks you to stand with Ukraine or donate to Ukraine. But we have to understand both sides of the issue and make up our minds. And as Americans right now, we have to know that Vladimir Zelensky, who ran on a peace platform and took a different line than all of the previous presidents, like Petro Poroshenko, who is a nationalist, hardliner, very pro-war, has become the war president and provides, with his acting background, the perfect public relations vehicle for escalating conflict and turning Ukraine into a new Syria, but on a much greater scale that will flood Europe with migrants and create a catastrophe that we may not have seen since World War I across Europe. He is calling for a no-fly zone. He is demanding that NATO wage conventional war with a nuclear power in Russia. And that's something that even the Biden administration says is going a little too far. So that's who Zelensky is. And as we illustrated in our piece, Alex Rubenstein and myself, he has gone from pushing for some kind of negotiation according to the Minsk agreement, which Ukraine constantly violated, to working with these neo-Nazi units and at least negotiating with them and collaborating with them and being weakened consistently by them, and the United States on the other side, to the point where the war was kind of becoming inevitable. I can go through specific incidents of him.
Sure, go ahead.
Well, I mean, on December 1st, 2021, Vladimir Zelensky, in an official ceremony in the Ukrainian Rada, the Ukrainian parliament, honored a leader of the neo-fascist battalion Right Sector, whose nickname is Da Vinci, who has boasted that he it was sort of a joke, but he said this to the New York Times, that he has a pet wolf and he feeds it with the bones of Russian-speaking children. Right Sector bears the red and black flag of the UPA, the Ukrainian Partisan Army, that collaborated with Nazi Germany and participated in the pogroms against the ethnic Polish community and participated in the Lviv pogrom, which was one of the worst pogroms against Ukraine's Jewish community during the Holocaust of bullets. And Zelensky has held meetings with leaders of C-14, as well as Right Sector and the Azov Battalion, to discuss what will happen in the East. Will they pull back according to various components of the Minsk agreement? And each and every time he backed down to them. He backed down every time. So it doesn't matter if he's Jewish or not. The question is whether he was the man of peace that he campaigned on, because when he ran for president in 2019, he was campaigning with the support of the Russian-speaking population. Hmm. I mean, I spoke to several of them. I spoke to a lawmaker in Crimea at the time, actually, who told me that the only hope was Zelensky.
In other words,
this is a pro-Russian.
The time, the guy who was in power was the legacy of the coup, but there had been another election, and even though the people of the Donbass had been excluded, this guy was seen as a guy who could bridge the gap between the major factions there. And that was how he got elected.
Exactly. And everyone wanted peace. Ethnic Russians wanted peace. The Russian population wanted peace. The people of Crimea wanted peace, who'd been annexed, who were pro-Russia. The Ukrainian majority wanted peace. That's what Zelensky was supposed to do. And he proved to be completely hollow and just every bit the actor, there was really no force he could lean on. Yeah. When it turned out that he was just a puppet for the United States and that the military muscle that he had to bring to bear were ultra-nationalists. So here he is running around begging NATO to wage direct warfare on a nuclear army and thrust the world into World War III.
That was Max Blumenthal, founder of The Gray Zone at grayzone.com, speaking on Anti-War Radio with Scott Horton on KPFK Los Angeles about his latest article, co-authored with Alexander Rubinstein, entitled, quote, How Ukraine's Jewish President Zelensky Made Peace with Neo-Nazi Paramilitaries on Front Lines of War with Russia, unquote. Hillary Clinton spoke to MSNBC recently, saying that the U.S. should prepare for a long-term Ukrainian insurgency along the lines of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan from the 1980s.
But remember, the Russians invaded Afghanistan back in 1980, and although no country went in, they certainly had a lot of countries supplying arms and advice and even some advisors to those who were recruited to fight Russia. It didn't end well for the Russians. There were other unintended consequences, as we know. But the fact is that a very motivated and then funded and armed insurgency basically drove the Russians out of Afghanistan.
For comments, we go to journalist and activist Brian Becker of the Answer Coalition in conversation with Esther Averam, host of On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital on Pacifica's WPFW, Washington, D.C.
It's incredible what Hillary Clinton said. She said there's some unintended consequences, but so what? They were a well-funded, motivated insurgency. These are the people who became Al-Qaeda. These are the people who the United States said its top priority from 2000, you know, up until 2018 was the war on terror against Al-Qaeda. And when she says some unintended consequences, it wasn't just September 11th. Look what happened to the people in Afghanistan. You know, women and girls had rights during the socialist government in Afghanistan. Peasants had the right to land. There was land to the tiller. Workers had the right to minimum wage. I mean, the Afghan revolution had so much promise, and the U.S. deliberately funded these so-called Mujahideen who became Al-Qaeda. They were funding Osama bin Laden. They destroyed not just the Soviets in Afghanistan, because the Soviets actually were winning that war in Afghanistan when Gorbachev pulled the troops out. They wanted to end the conflict for the Soviet side, but it destroyed the people of Afghanistan. It began a war that ended not until really 2021. It plunged Afghanistan into 40 years of war. So to all of the people who are crying crocodile tears right now about Ukrainians, if you listen to U.S. policymakers, they don't give a damn. They don't give a damn. They don't care about Ukrainians any different than they don't care about the people of Afghanistan. Those people in Afghanistan and the people in Ukraine are simply pawns in this geostrategic contest to weaken Russia, not because Russia is menacing the United States, but the U.S. can't treat Russia as an equal major power in the world, because countries in Europe would start to gravitate in the direction of Russia and the U.S. hegemonic position, the world order that was established after World War II, where the U.S. was the boss of the capitalist world, that would start to shatter. And so the cynicism here, I mean, thank you, Hillary Clinton, for being so honest. In your imperialist language. Go ahead, Esther.
Well, I think that a lot of people in the United States and throughout Europe agree with you, and they know that it's true. Corporate media may think that they have everyone in their palm, but there's a sizable part of the population who's seen this playbook before, and they know what happened in Iraq. They know what happened in Afghanistan. They know what happened in Libya, and they know what's happening now. But I wanted to say another point about what Hillary Clinton is saying. When she's talking about funding an insurgency, you're talking about funding and putting weapons in the hands of the most radical edge of fighters against whoever you're trying to defeat. And in Ukraine, that's the far right. That is the Azov Battalion. That is all the neo-Nazis coming from around Europe or wherever they're trying to recruit foreign fighters to go there and fight Russia. And so when we hear about rogue actions and and we speculate about whether Zelensky really has power over all these different factions coming to fight there or that are there right now fighting. That's what we have to look at. And they're basically talking about funding neo-Nazis and the far-right element to fight in Ukraine.
That was Esther Iverum, host of On the Ground, Voices of Resistance, from Pacifica's WPFW, Washington, D.C., in conversation with journalist and activist Brian Becker. To hear their full conversation, check out the Socialist Program podcast. Claire Daly is a member of the European Parliament from Dublin, Ireland. She spoke at the Parliament plenary on March 7th, 2022.
There's no doubt about it. We're living in times of catastrophic crisis where the lives of innocent civilians are sacrificed in the wars of their masters. Yes, in Ukraine, but not only. Since the last plenary, tens of thousands of Afghani citizens have been forced to flee in search of food and safety. 5 million children face famine, an agonising and painful death, a 500% increase in child marriages and children being sold just so they can survive, and not a mention of it, not here, not anywhere. No wall-to-wall TV coverage, no emergency humanitarian response, no special plenaries, not even a mention in this plenary, no Afghani delegations and no statements. My God, they must be wondering, what makes their humanitarian crisis so unimportant? Is it the colour of their skin? Is it that they're not white? They're not European? That their problems come from a US gun or a US invasion? Is it that the decision to rob their country's wealth was taken by a despotic US president rather than a Russian one? Because, my God, all wars are evil and all victims deserve support. And until we get on that page, we have no credibility whatsoever.
That was Claire Daly, member of the European Parliament from Dublin, Ireland. Over the past 20 years, U.S. and allied forces have dropped more than 337,000 bombs and missiles on other countries, an average of 46 strikes per day. That's according to the official air power summary data from January of this year. And that concludes today's edition of COVID Race and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by Polina Vasiliev and Steve Seltzer. Our executive producers are Akua Holt, Polina Vasiliev, and Steve Seltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. You can follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.
That was a recent edition of Pacifica Radio's nationally syndicated program, COVID Race and Democracy, here on Conscious Voices, which is heard each week at this time on your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll be with you again next week for another edition. Take care. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.
This is Professor Howard Zinn. The independent, non-commercial radio station you're listening to is really important in the maintenance of democracy. Thomas Jefferson once said, an informed democracy will behave in a reasonable manner. So if you care about being informed, if you care about democracy, if you're a reasonable person, you are, of course, please support your source for uncensored news and views and the voice of your community.